Something's living on my skin. Doctor, please, doctor, please, open up, it's me again. I go to a famous physician. I sleep in the local hotel. From what I can see, the people like me, we get better, but we never get well. So
oh man, welcome to another episode of Health Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Patrick Lavo. Oh, hey, there we go. Sorry, gang. I don't think I was broadcasting myself. Welcome to another episode of Health Matters. I'm Dr. Patrick Lavo, and I'm going to be your host this evening. And tonight, as you may have guessed from our opening song, we are going to be discussing allergies and immunology specifically. I'm pretty excited about it because I'm an ENT, so this is like, I like to think that I'm good at allergies, but I know that my guest tonight does not agree with that, and that's fine.
Oh, I totally agree with that. You're great.
That's very sweet of you to say. You have to. We're in public. That's fine. Allergy and immunology. She is an allergy and immunologist. She studied at the University of Miami and trained in internal medicine and then moved to California. So coast to coast, went to UC Irvine for allergy and immunology fellowship. This is Dr. Caroline Caperton. Welcome, Dr. Caperton.
Thank you so much. See, shining sea, proud American, trained.
Wait, so where are you from?
Born and raised Thibodaux, Louisiana.
No way.
Yes way.
So you've just been everywhere.
I hail from the South. I'm a product of this lovely state, and I am proud to be back and serving the good people of Louisiana.
Well, we're glad to have you. I know. Indeed. I have referred some patients to you, and so I am glad to have
Likewise.
You specifically. Now, if at any time you out there listening would like to join in on the conversation, we are at 1-800-552-8502. We would love to have any questions, any comments. Dr. Caperton is at your disposal. And as a subspecialist, that's hard to achieve on a daily basis. So I would say now's a great time to call in. 1-800-552-8502. So, what do you do? I mean, I feel like that's one of those things. Okay, so this is, you touched on it a little bit when you said, I trained here, and then I trained here, and you did all this stuff.
Right.
So what does it even take to become an allergist in the first place? Because I feel like nobody really understands how medicine works or how you get to be in a place.
Yes.
So give me a basic, like, walk down.
Kind of
what did you do?
My friends are like, are you ever going to, like, you get this MD, this MSPH, are you ever going to get a JOB? And I'm like, yeah, I'm working on it.
One day.
So when you set out to help someone in the field of medicine, you generally will pursue higher education in terms of college in 4 years. And then after that, if you want to, if you're lucky enough to get into medical school at that point, you would go for another 4 years. Some of us have pursued masters of, say, science and public health, which I did at University of Miami as well. And that's where we study stuff like public health, epidemiology, things that we've heard over the last year.
Sure.
And so I was lucky enough to be able to get that in Miami as well. So that's an additional 2 years training. And then I went to medical school, actually. And so 4 years there. And I did a year of dermatology clinic and research. And then, so I kind of like skin and rashes, and I like seeing them on different skin colors, ethnicities. And that's why training in Miami was important to me and seeing international things, because rashes look different on black and white and other colors of skin. And so that was important to me to be able to see that. And from a public health perspective, to bring that into my practice. And so after that, I did internal medicine residency. So how are we carry the one? That's three more years. And then, finally, I was like, that's not enough. So let me learn some more stuff about allergy and immunology. And in fellowship training, generally it's two more years. And then at the ripe old age of 40, here we are. And I've been practicing in this area for 4 years.
I finally got a job.
Yeah, a year before that elsewhere.
I bet your parents were delighted.
Delighted to be out of school. Are they like, are you done? Are you done yet? Yes.
Man, so you are at least qualified to say you should probably get rid of the cat because it's causing you problems.
I know. You know what? When you tell people to get rid of their pets, they just get rid of their allergist. So I've learned to kind of like help them to mitigate these strategies with some avoidance strategies. And maybe the cat doesn't need to sleep on your head. Maybe you can sleep on the floor. Maybe you can sleep outside the bedroom. But I can help you to kind of live with said cat if you are a cat person or a dog person. And there are things that we can do to help you to live comfortably with those other fuzzy family members and make you less miserable and symptomatic.
Man. Well, that actually brings up an interesting question that I've had. This is something that I've wondered. This is you know, anything is on topic for today, by the way, as long as it pertains to allergy and immunology,
yes.
presumably. And asthma.
Yes.
I think we can talk about asthma. I think we can talk about the vaccine a little bit because
yes,
I think that you've got some interesting stuff to say about that.
Yes.
But I'm going to start off with what's most near and dear to my heart, which is how are poodles hypoallergenic?
They're
or
not!
Is that just a load
That's
of...
That's such a myth.
Okay.
Okay.
So like, okay, because everybody says like, I got the golden doodle because it's not going to trigger my allergies.
Right.
Is this accurate?
No. So there is a hair versus fur argument. There are animals that release more dander than others. Some of them hold the dander closer to the chest, if you will, so to speak. But all animals have dander.
Mm-hmm.
And the
what is dander?
Dander is this allergenic component. It's like fluff and fur and skin cells, and it has this... this CANE D1 protein that is the allergenic component that trips up your allergy cells. So it's this like perfect little trigger to the landmine of allergy on your cells. You have these receptors. And so these antigens that are specific to, say, cat, say, dog, say, dust mite, those things will be specific to an allergy cell that maybe you are or are not sensitized to. And I can help you find that out. But that perfect little key to that receptor locks and key to that mechanism unleashes your allergy cells like stepping on a landmine. And within 15 to 30 minutes of exposure to this antigen, we'll call it, your cells release like water balloons, all these mediators of inflammation and allergy and itchingness, histamines. That's why we take antihistamines, leukotrienes. Some of you may be on something called an leukotriene receptor antagonist. What the heck is that? Singulair or Montelukast? So these sorts of antihistamines can help you mitigate the response that your cells will have when that lock and key receptor hits those cells and releases the badness onto you.
Okay, so poodles still have that,
poodles still have that, unfortunately.
So are they less that?
I mean, I'm supposed to say, but my textbook will tell you no. However, I've heard arguments like, well, I'm not allergic to my dog. It's my wife's dog. You know, it's like, okay, well, they still have the dander. So there are things that you can do, strategies such as like washing them once a week, grooming them outdoors, giving them their own place to sleep in, that will reduce their amount of dander and amount of triggering allergen for you. So you have less tidbits to fall on your allergy cells to trigger that release of histamines. So if you reduce that dander, then you're going to reduce the triggering inciting events.
Man.
Does that make sense?
I feel like I've been lied to. So does this just mean poodles have a really great lobby? I mean, like, what happened?
They really
here?
Do. They're like the smartest breed, I feel like.
They hired their own lobbyists.
Yeah, and they hire their own lobbyists.
Okay, so I mean, is that something that you have to deal with? You said this already, that you kind of run into people who, if you tell them to get rid of their pet, they get rid of their allergies.
They do.
So, like, what's your number one guideline for someone who comes in and they're allergic to Fluffy? And we can't get rid of it.
It's hard.
The kids love it.
I have a she's going to be 15 in October. Lola is my 15-year-old Pomeranian that I'm allergic to. I found this out in fellowship. And, I knew she was I was symptomatic around her, and I, you know what? I'm not going to get rid of my dog. That's a family member. So she used to be able to snuggle in bed. We don't do that anymore. She has her own little bed.
Sure.
I keep her outside the bedroom, and we groom her regularly. I wash her outside. I groom her outside. And then, you know what? There's always your, so if you can't beat them, you try to join them. So if you can't reduce your exposure, like pollens, you can't kick pollen out of your life. It's just going to be there. So there are
you
certain,
can. It you, just involves moving.
Yeah.
Like you can't if you want to stay here.
This is true.
I have so many people who come to me and they're like, Doc, I was phenomenal on my vacation.
Yes.
And then I came home and I feel terrible again. I'm like, well, you could always just go on a permanent vacation. Like that's your option.
I know. So geographically restricted as we are, certain allergens are difficult to avoid. So what we're going to tell people is, okay, the mask wearing can help if you're going to have unavoidable exposure or you can't pay the kid next door to cut your grass if you can do so.
Mm-hmm.
If not, then try to do, the things that you can do are going inside and stripping down, showering off, reducing that allergen content like we talked about. Doing things like washing out your sinus passages with a pre-made saline rinse or a distilled water saline salt-based rinse, like our NeelMed sinus rinses or Simply Saline or something like that. So those things can rinse out the nasal passages. And then once you kind of gently blow your nose, you go in with some over-the-counter intranasal Corticosteroid, a.k.a. Flonase, a.k.a. Nasacort, hashtag not sponsored, hashtag amenable to sponsorship. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, seriously.
Right?
Like,
yeah, so
I've sent that Dr. Neelmed's kids to college at this point.
So have I.
So I feel like at some point.
Yes, and so people that are kind of averse to medications, really sensitive to medications, the saline mists are the best. It's just like washing your nasal passages out with salt and a little bicarb, and it's not like waterboarding. It's not like, who do you work for? Willis Knighton. No, it's washing that out. It's very balanced pH. It's actually a nice, pleasant experience. There's YouTube videos. You can kind of see how to do that. And
those YouTube videos
out,
are too smug, though.
Yeah, they are.
Because it's some little kid staring at you in the camera, and he thinks he's better
like
than you.
Eye contact.
I can wash my nose out. And you look at him, and you're like, well, I feel like I'm drowning. And he's he doesn't
care. And he's
care.
Just doing it. Because
I struggle with those.
It's not that bad anymore. I know.
No, it gets better.
You
I always try
psych yourself up.
I try
bit.
To warn people that, like, the first couple times you do this, you will feel like you're waterboarding yourself.
It does.
Because it's terrible. But then I promise, if you can do it for, like, a week, by the end of that week, you'll actually start liking it.
Absolutely.
So, but you do have to struggle. It's like running.
A little bit.
You know, the first time you go running, it's miserable. And then as you get into it a little bit, you're like, oh, actually, this is kind of nice.
I've never gotten the runner's high. I try.
Oh, man.
I know. I'm a swimmer. But anyway.
That's worse. That is far worse. At least in running, you can breathe consistently. With swimming, it's like, maybe you can breathe.
I know. I like the solitary thought process.
Oh gosh.
Washing out the sinus passages, then you're going to go in with like something like a Flonase or a Nasacort.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, it has a teeny tiny bit of local steroid. People get freaked out, but it's micrograms of steroid, and that's going to shrink down when you have this congestion and you just can't breathe and you sound like this and you're like, why can't I breathe? Because you have these things called turbinates in there. What? And they're swollen, so you shrink them down and now you can breathe, and it's going to be over a consistent period of time. It's not going to happen right away. It's going to happen over consistent use of that shrinking down of your turbinates over time, like 7 to 10 days period, which you well know as ENT better than I do. So that's going to reduce down that inflammation in there. And then you can take your over-the-counter antihistamine, your Zyrtex, your Claritin, your Allegra's generic is just fine. And then there are things that we can prescribe. If that's inadequate to control your symptoms, then there's stuff that we have tricks up our sleeve that we can help you with, intranasal antihistamines,
sure.
Other things that are more potent, first-generation antihistamines. And then there's always allergy shots. So what the heck is that? So people get freaked out. It's a teeny tiny little needle, about the size of an insulin shot. And it's like in the pinch of inch chicken skin behind your arm. And what we do is we make a concoction of stuff that you're allergic to, specific for you, dilute it down to the lowest concentration. And we gradually, incrementally increase your dosing of that shot over a period of weeks. Maybe 33 weeks to a buildup phase where you're coming frequently. And then as you're getting higher in dosing and concentration, you're noticing I can tolerate a whole bunch of allergens coming at me without releasing my histamines. So now I can tolerate the neighbor's cat without going into a conniption fit of sneezing and itching and watery eyes, because now my allergy cells are like, oh, this is cool. I don't have to freak out. So it's desensitizing you to those things. And then once you reach this maintenance dosing, it's about once a month. Patients generally come for shots about once a month for about 3 to 5 years for a long-term benefit, which is about 8 to 10 years. And then, you know, and we see how it goes after that.
I think we did it. I think we cured allergies just now.
Isn't that cool?
I think you and that 10-minute block fixed them.
It's what I do better than CVS aisle 5 is what I do.
I mean, seriously. Now, here's a question. You mentioned something that I, first of all, I feel like we could break down each of those different subjects that you've just brought up. The intranasal steroids, I think, is kind of an interesting conversation, just because originally, I mean, that was all prescription only. And so what happened? What did they like sell out? Did Walmart discover the formula? I mean, what happened? Why? Because now you can get literally all of them over the counter.
All of them over the counter. And so FDA appropriately monitors public health and monitors the drugs available to the public, both pharmaceutical strength and over the counter. So when a drug first comes out and we're looking at prescription strength and all of that, and the ones over the counter now are the exact same strength that were once prescription. So after a period of time, and the safety profile has been thoroughly investigated for years and years and years, and they've seen that the benefit to the public is greater than the risk to the public through the prescriptions, that's when the FDA and the powering body who says whether or not this stuff should be available to the public. They say, you know what? The benefit to the public is far greater than the risk to the public. Let's make this available without a prescription. They're unlikely to cause great harm to themselves if that's available to them at great quantities. So let's release this to the public to allow them to get this without the barrier of a prescription or having to see a physician or something. And then they can benefit from this. So all you see at Costco and Sam's and Walmart and everything is like, pollen season comes, the shelves are stacked with the Flonase and the Nasacort because that's what benefits patients. And it's really good that they don't have to wait on a script to get that.
Right.
So we should all take advantage of that and say, okay, you know what? Let me try that. The right answer on our test for allergists is, hey, patient comes in and they've got seasonal allergies. Do they take a Zyrtec, a Claritin? You know, what's the right answer? The right answer is Flonase on our test, above Claritin.
Always.
Above an antihistamine pill. It's really easy to pop a pill, but the right answer is the Flonase.
But what about like Rhinocort? Is it different?
Rhinocort is actually the choice for pregnant women or women who are lactating, hoping to become pregnant. Not that it's necessarily safer. It's just that budesonide molecule, the molecule that is the steroid, has been very well studied in the pregnant population. And so we feel quite comfortable prescribing that one to pregnant people. And Rhinocort,
what if you're not pregnant?
Is it any better? If you're not pregnant, it won't make you pregnant, which is good.
That's true. That's a different show. Tune in next week.
No, if you're not pregnant, it works just the same. It's just that molecule's been really well studied for pregnant women. It's not that if you're on a Flonase, do I switch you to Rhinocort? I mean, no. I might bring it up to you and advise you. But the medication that's currently best controlling your symptoms is probably the one you should stay on. The others are safe enough that I continued my Flonase in my pregnancy, and I have a beautiful, healthy baby girl. So
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. So I think that the Rhinocort has been best studied. They've gotten away from the categories. They used to say, like, hey, this drug is category A, category B, category X, you know. So now they're saying this drug is very well studied in pregnancy, and we feel confident prescribing it. Or, you know what? There's just not enough evidence. We don't know. And so Rhinocort is one of those it's confident prescribing for pregnant people. So that's a good one you brought up. Thanks.
Well, and I mean, and another thing that I hear all the time, I think that I'd love to hear your take on, is people will come and they'll say, you know, I've been taking Allegra for 2 years and it just stopped working for me. So then I had to switch to Claritin and that worked for a year and then that stopped working for me. So then I had to switch to, you know, insert antihistamine here. Do you find that there is such a thing as like antihistamine fatigue or antihistamine tolerance that is legitimate, or is that
just a perceived thing? It is kind of like a shampoo stops working after a while, you know? It's like it's still cleaning your hair. You just kind of perceive this lack of benefit, and people's chemistry changes all the time. There is a gained benefit from a cumulative dose. So say you're taking Zyrtec, and you take it 2, 3, 4 days at a time. Now that concentration of that drug in your system has built up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that will help you even if you miss a dose or something, because you still have that lingering in your system. Mm-hmm. For example, we tell patients to be off antihistamines for 5 to 7 days prior to a skin test. If you're taking Allegra, say, that drug, the half-life of that drug may wear off faster. So Claritin may last longer. It's dependent on the pharmacokinetics of that drug and how they work with your own chemistry. And so for some patients, they find that changes. Maybe they, you know, something changes with their hormones or something and one works better than another. I believe it. You know, I don't know that that's been very well studied in a good population to say, like, let's see who works. And I think medicine's going that way, to be more individualized. And maybe one day we'll be able to like prick a finger and get a genome exome sequencing and say, this drug's going to work better for you than this one, than that one. They're kind of hoping that will work that way with hypertension and cardiovascular drugs.
Right.
Even. But for now, we say, well, try one. If that doesn't work, just like shampoo, switch it up, try it up or a different one. What I will tell you is some patients that have kidney disease or liver disease or gut issues, we choose different antihistamines based on their particular circumstance. So if you have one that's maybe metabolized more through the kidneys, such as Zyrtec, and if you have a renal problem, you might want to watch your dosing. You might want to just double check with your primary care physician or your allergist or your nephrologist and say, hey, is this the right drug for me? Maybe you should think about switching to one that's not renally metabolized. If you are, you know, if you take Allegra, for example, it's more metabolized by the gut and a little bit of the liver. So you would not want to take Allegra with fatty foods or fruit juice because it limits the absorption. But it's also least sedating, and it kicks in within probably 30 minutes or so. So my first responders and people who I need to be alert, like my pilots and stuff, I say, hey, take Allegra or Claritin.
Sure.
Because Zyrtec, 7 to 10% of people can get a little sleepy. But it really works. If you have a hives patient, for example, or a patient who they're miserable, they're itching, maybe a slight sedative quality would be beneficial in those patients. Or maybe take it at night. And then just about when the patent expires on these drugs, they're like, hey, let's make a mirror image of it. Cetirizine is the generic for Zyrtec. That's the green bottle. And then you like switch it and make a mirror image. Levocetirizine. What? New patent. That's Zizol. Yeah.
Love it.
So that's how they do it. But
is Zizol better? Is its mirror image more effective?
Because it's newer?
Yeah, it's new.
Fancier?
Newer is always better, right? I mean, come on. First
generation. If you want to pay $10 a pill versus five, have at it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't use Benadryl. It's first gen.
First
gen. So second gen is Zizol.
Second gens.
Is Zyrtec.
So first gen and second gen, people don't get that. So old school first generation antihistamines, they really work. That's like our Benadryls. That's like our Atarax or hydroxyzines. So those work really well, but they're shorter acting. So they're like maybe 6 to 8 hours, but they also knock you out and make you sleepy. So they're really bad choices for older patients or patients who are maybe on blood thinners, who have a fall risk. Because the last thing you want to do is give someone that's like has mobility issues on a blood thinner, something that's going to make them fall, break a hip, or bleed. So that maybe you want to think about those if you have older parents or people that you're caring for in your life that are itching and scratching and popping a Benadryl. Maybe you want to think about speaking with them about a second generation antihistamine, which is non-sedating, which lasts longer, like 24 hours. And that might be a better choice for them.
But quote unquote non-sedating.
Quote unquote non-sedating, exactly.
Because you said what, 7 to 10%?
7 to 10% on the Zyrtec, yeah. And you might not even perceive it. You know, I'm one of those people that's like, oh, I love me some Zyrtec, but then I don't perceive that I am less alert. However, if I were a first responder, I would probably be like, you know what? Let me look at the Allegras. Let me look at the Claritins. Mm-hmm. Because if your reaction time matters, then that's something to consider.
I mean, it's fat. There's so much to consider. Who would have known? You wander down the allergy aisle and
allergy.
You think to yourself, like, I'm just going to grab a couple of these pills and
you
head for the hills. Now, is there a reason that people use things like Benadryl and not Zyrtec when you're talking about, like, an allergic reaction that someone's having, like anaphylaxis, or you go to the hospital and you're saying, like, my throat's closing up? They don't give you Zyrtec.
Correct. So the quick onset of action is something that we look for in, like, Benadryls.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we would look for. Interesting you say that, because if you're having a life-threatening allergic reaction called anaphylaxis, where you have, you might have itchy, watery eyes, runny nose, but the symptoms are escalating to the point to where you feel like maybe you can't breathe, maybe your tongue is swelling, maybe your lip is swelling, you're having wheezing, you're having hives, any combination of those symptoms. Some people, all they have is a drop in their blood pressure. And that can be an anaphylactic reaction.
Mm-hmm.
The only treatment that will reverse all of those symptoms is epinephrine. So the treatment of choice if you are having a life-threatening allergic reaction is not Benadryl, is not Claritin, is not nasal spray, it is not steroids, it is epinephrine. And if I get one point across today, besides get vaccinated, it's that. So that epinephrine in the event of anaphylaxis is the only thing that you should do, and call 911 if you do. Because it is adrenaline. So it's produced by your own adrenal glands, and it will reverse all those symptoms. It will speed up your heart and open up your airways and allow you to breathe and get to safety. So if you inject it, however, you do want to be seen in the ER, because there's snowballs that your body throws at you, and then it kind of has time to make more. And then 6 to 8 hours later, it can throw the second set of snowballs at you and have kind of a second wave of anaphylaxis. And so then we monitor you and monitor your pulse ox, make sure you're good, give you some steroids perhaps, and follow up with your allergists on discharge to find out what the heck happened. And so we can prevent it from happening again, hopefully.
Yeah, no kidding. So use your epi if you've got an anaphylactic reaction.
Absolutely.
Uh-oh. Okay, so now I'm playing the Bare Naked Ladies, or the BNL, as those of us that love them call them. This is a segment that I enjoy maybe more than any other segment on the show. Have you ever listened to Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Minutes, yes. Long time caller, first time listener.
There you go. It's an NPR show where they interview famous people, and they have a segment called That's Not My Job, where they'll interview famous authors about what it's like to be a firefighter, or they'll interview astronauts about what it's like to be a coal miner.
Oh, this should be fun.
And so I'm going to ask you a series of questions. Well, I'm only going to ask you one question now. I'm going to ask you another question later, but right now I'm just going to ask you one question. So you're an allergist.
Yes.
And therefore you should know a lot about allergies.
That's what they tell me.
There's a lot of cats and allergies. So I'm just going to ask you some cat facts.
Okay.
So of these things, with the exception of maybe mold, it feels
like— I know my friend Sanford Katz. He's a frequent host here.
He is.
Speaking of cats.
1-800-552-8502. Dr. Katz, call in. With the exception of maybe mold, it feels like that the most common allergen in the U.S. seems to be cats. And it's probably not true, but it feels that way. Whether you're an emotional allergy or an actual physical allergy, the cat is real. These are some cat questions for you. Now, in this game, I have one true answer and three lies. You have to deduce which of these is actually a cat fact and which of these are just made up.
I'm nervous.
You're going to do great.
Okay.
My greatest delight is when I get people. So if you get one, if you get it right, I'm going to be disappointed.
Stop on a whammy.
All right. So number one, cats don't care. In experiments where cats witnessed their owner in apparent pain, they demonstrated no heightened level of alertness and made no attempt to join or comfort them.
I feel like that's so true.
Two, cats are very lazy. They spend 2/3 of the day sleeping and 1/3 of their awake time is spent cleaning themselves. Number three, catnip is highly addictive. And owners who have eaten catnip have reported that it has symptoms and trips similar to LSD. Or number four, cats always land on their feet, partially because of their flexibility and their rotation around their spine, but also in part to their specialized foot pads, which are able to sense the Earth's magnetic field.
Hmm.
One of these is true.
One of them's true.
The
it's definitely the one
up
about them not caring. Because I feel like I saw some sort of vestibular system about the cat. I feel like the cat, the magnetic pad thing, that's not true. Yeah, I feel like they don't care.
I think they don't care, but that has not been
demonstrated. Dang it!
I don't think anybody's done the study where they hurt people and had cats watch. I mean,
I'm just kidding. After the Nuremberg trials, that's kind of frowned upon.
If they did, I would love to. I would really actually be interested to read that study. No, it's cats are lazy. They spend 2/3 of their sleep and 1/3 of their awake time they are cleaning themselves.
I mean, the cleaning themselves part seems kind of diligent, though.
But I mean, what are they? They don't have time to get dirty. They're only
right.
That's nuts.
But they have the dander.
And catnip also might be highly addictive, but
FeLD1 is the allergenic component of cats, if you guys were following along in your trivia books, kids.
I write that down. That's going to come up. If you go to trivia later, you're going to want to know that because it's going to come up. FeLD1. All right. So
I have a Ryan Gosling meme and he's holding a kitten and it says, "I FeLD1 hard for you."
Oh gosh.
No. No.
No. Okay. That's just one of those things that only allergists laugh at.
It's hilarious.
That's not something that the general public finds amusing. 1-800-552-8502. If you have any questions for an allergy/immunology specialist, you just want to chat, you want to call in, give us a call. We're happy to talk to you. So, now you had said that first of all, you had kind of mentioned public health earlier.
Yes.
You talked about like the value of public health to you. You had mentioned that you were interested in the vaccine. Now, describe to me how your interest in that, it all stems from allergy immunology, or are you just a public health whiz, because you said you did a
Master of Science in Public Health.
So okay, so you are just a public health aficionado.
I kind of just like people, and I like patients, and I feel like if I had a patient in front of me that I could help, that would be the greatest thing in my life. And then if I had a patient in front of me that I couldn't help, telling them, "Oh, there's nothing I can do for you," would just crush my soul. So you kind of say, hey, maybe let's see if there's a whole lot of more people like you and see if we can get y'all together and see what's similar or dissimilar, see if there's something we can do to help all of you. And then it's taught me to kind of look at the patient in front of me and see the population behind them. And how can I kind of help that patient and help the public as a whole in every person that I serve? And, you know, that goes to antibiotic stewardship, that goes to vaccinations, that goes to education. And if I can educate patients to educate others, then we all help each other rise. And I mean, everybody's lived through the pandemic last year. Golly, we're just ready to get out there. We're ready to just rip the masks off and go to a baseball game and, you know, take the kids to the parks and get together and hug again. And I want that for us. I want our economy back on track. And it's scary. I know it's scary. But the best thing that we have right now to get us out of here, to parachute us out of this pandemic, is a vaccination. And I know it's scary and people think that it's rushed and people think that it's not well studied. This technology has been in effect for so long for cancer therapeutics, and we have the most brilliant and beautiful minds in the world working together on a common goal with money behind it. Powerful money and people. Red tape has been removed, but not the standards of health and not the standards of safety. So when you have this technology that's been very well studied and safely used in a lot of people, millions of people, you know, it's something that we should really look critically into.
I mean, I agree. There's these part of me that wants to, like, not play devil's advocate, but I mean,
absolutely.
You know, I feel like I understand some of it because, you know, you think about, like, when's the last time anything ever went this well in a coordinated effort as a government program,
right?
Ever?
Yes.
Ever.
I mean, I'm from Louisiana, so we're used to the chicken in every pot, Huey Long politics. And so
right.
That bridge is still standing, I think, right?
It is.
Yeah. Hey. I mean since that bridge.
He was a stand-up guy, you know, Huey P. Long.
Yeah, he was.
Not at all embroiled in controversy.
But anyway, that's another caller thing. But, you know, people kind of forget pandemics, and people kind of forget how bad, I don't know, smallpox was, and people forget iron lungs, and people forget polio. We've done so well as a society saying this is bad. We want to not have this happen. So, you know, through science and research, we've been able to inoculate our immune system to say, hey, you know what? This is a bad guy. Let's learn about this immune system. So then when you see it in real life, it doesn't cripple you with polio. It doesn't take over your lungs, and it doesn't end you. It doesn't kill you. Quite
frankly, what's the magic number for getting vaccinated that, you know, ends this mess?
I've heard it say up to, you know, right now, Louisiana, we're not even at probably a third of our population vaccinated. And the problem is, this thing is going to keep spreading. So, and when it keeps spreading, it gets really smart and it jumps and it variants. It's so, like, this Delta variant you hear about now is because it's infecting patients, and as it moves and infects other patients, it's can mutate, just like the common cold, just like the flu. So that's why every year we have to get a flu shot, because there are variants of the flu vaccine,
right?
The flu virus. And so we kind of base our flu shots based on the winter season in, say, Australia. Because when it's summer here, it's winter there. So right now they're going through their flu seasons. And we kind of meet, I think, collectively, we as an immunologist will meet, and public health officials will meet, and look and see what the strains were in Australia and that were killing people. And we say, you know what? That's probably a good one to put in our mix this year. So we will choose those prevalent strains. And you know what? Yeah, it's a guess, because we're predicting which ones are going to happen here.
Right.
And it could mutate by the time it gets here. Some years we're more effective and better guessers than others. And some years the flu shot is more effective than other years. However, it's still a heck of a lot better than getting the flu. And if you get your flu shot annually, now you've built this cool repertoire of, like, greatest hits of strains. And so next time, if they guessed wrong, now you kind of have that one back in the stash and be like, you know what? That was, like, bare naked ladies back in the day. I know that jam. I'm not going to get sick with the flu this year.
I don't think anyone has ever referred to getting all your vaccines as having the stash of
have a stash, because your cells are super smart and they have a memory, and they're going to be like, that guy, I'm on it. I got
greatest
this for you.
Hits. The flu's greatest hits.
Yes.
Hey, we actually have a caller. Caller from Covington, Louisiana. You are on with Dr. Caperton. How can we talk to you today? What can we do for you?
Hi, yes. I've been talking to people, and they keep saying that this vaccine is not safe because it was developed so quickly. What are your thoughts on that?
Hi, yes. So thank you for calling very much. And I think you're expressing the thoughts and the concerns of a lot of these patients. They're saying, oh my gosh, it's just so fast. We don't know about this stuff. The technology for the mRNA vaccinations has been in the works for years. And what's really cool about, I think it's the most elegantly designed vaccination that's come out in a very, very long time. As we are developing more biologic medications for asthma, for rheumatology, for dermatology, you might have heard of things like targeted biologics that take out your T cells and stuff, and those sorts of medications that tone down your immune system for arthritis or psoriasis, or, you know, those medicines you see on TV all the time. What's happening is older medications had a lot of collateral damage. And so you'd take out one thing, but you would leave a lot of other damage in the immune system. And this vaccine is not doing that. This vaccine is saying, I need to do this. I need to give a spike protein to the immune system without actually infecting it. So what you have is a little secret message. It's called a messenger RNA. This stuff is so fragile, it degrades so fast that you got to keep it super cold. You got to wrap it in a polyethylene glycol, kind of like a Miralax molecule, right? And you keep it super cold because it degrades so fast. It has no chance to make it to your own DNA. It has no chance to make it to your ovaries. It has no chance to make it anywhere besides like right locally where they inject it in your deltoid. And then your little dendritic cells will pick it up like little flowers and they'll bring it into your cytoplasm, which is not your nucleus. It never makes it into your own DNA. Okay, it takes it into your cytoplasm and your little cells that write down things will be like, okay, write it down. What does that message say? It says, make a spike. So then it makes a spike protein, right? Your little ribosomes will translate that message and then poof, it's gone. Where does it go? It's gone. Like any other messenger RNA in your system. You have a lot of that in your body that tells your cells to do stuff. And all of that degrades as soon as it's used. Makes other proteins, amino acids, and stuff like that. So now you have this little spike protein. And your immune system is like, what? What is that? Your T cell looks at it and is like, I'm sorry, is that a spike protein? And then, what the heck is that? And he goes, Bob, B cell, hello. And Bob's like, yes, ma'am. And she goes, Bob, I need you to make an antibody against this thing because I don't know what it is and we don't want it around here. And Bob's like, yes, dear. So he makes the antibody, right? And then y'all go along your merry way. Your immune system does this all the time with anything you encounter, any common virus, anything like that. Makes an antibody to it, just like you would get your tetanus shot, just like you got your good old school's vaccines. And so when your body sees it the next time, say you get a booster shot, then you make another little spike protein, right? And now your T cell goes, oh my gosh, is that a spike protein? Bob, I thought you took care of this. And Bob's like, I did. I made an antibody. And she's like, obviously, that's not enough. I need you to make more, right? We boost this thing because it's a pretty bad deal. So we need to boost to make sure you have protective antibodies. Because if you just have a mall cop there as a little antibody, he's not going to do anything against like coronavirus, right? So you got a little mall cop. And now you get a booster shot. Now you get more spike protein going on. And now the T cell looks at the B cell and is like, dude, I need some antibodies, right? And so B cell's like, I got you, boo. And he goes, boom. And then now you have this robust antibody response to the booster vaccination. And so that's how the vaccine works. And that's why you need those booster shots. Because the first one's just a mall cop. He's going to help you out. But I mean, when you're getting robbed, you need your backup support. So that's what the booster shots are going to do. That tells you that, look, you know, normally this might be okay, but in a pandemic, when you have so much virulent strains going around, you're going to need a big boost of immunity. And so that's what these things are doing. Just like patients who get COVID have this immunity, but it kind of wanes because the body's like, whoa, what was that? And I built some immunity. And then it kind of wanes because it figures I probably won't see that again. You know what? You might. And there's been reinfection rates. So the technology behind mRNA has been around for a very long time in cancer studies, and it's well characterized, and it's so elegant, the delivery system, and that it just will not make it into anything else. Your fertility is not affected. American College of Gynecology has actually come out with a statement. It's scientifically implausible. And so I can talk about that too. I get it. There's a big fear. I had my first child at 40. We visited two. I'm probably sharing more than I should, but we visited two fertility specialists. I would never do anything to harm my child. I got my vaccines third trimester because my daughter's risk from us being workers, healthcare workers, was far greater than the risk of the vaccination.
Sure.
So guess what? She came out perfect health, 40 weeks. With maternal transferred antibodies. We did a heel stick because we were doing her newborn screening anyway. Mm-hmm. She's got COVID protective antibodies. How cool is that?
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. So very few things I've done right as a mom. That's one of them. And so, you know, the thing is now maternal transferred IgG, which is what she has, is going to wane after 6 months. And so kiddo is going to be 5 months this coming Sunday. So, but you know, she's only going to have that protective immunity for another month. And
right.
Then we're relying on everybody else to protect our kids because kids can't get vaccinated yet. So, and I get the fear. I do get it. But at a certain point, you got to trust public health experts and the people who have your best interests at heart. I have no interest financially or out any other way by telling people to get this vaccine other than we're tired. We want our economy back open. We want our jobs back. You know, we want to be able to go out and hug our friends and go to the ball game. And as a society, we have a responsibility to each other to do the things that are going to protect us, to protect our neighbor, to protect our kids. And the vaccine is really one of them. So I encourage you to find good information, not internet information, not misinformation. And I don't know where we got so far away from trusting the people who have our best interests at heart anymore. When something becomes politicized, it's really, really unfortunate. And especially something like public health.
Yeah. Well, caller, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate you listening. We appreciate your participation. I think that there's a couple valid points that I think would be almost disingenuous to ignore, which is we genuinely don't know long-term effects of this. Like, I mean, that's not to say that it's bad. It's not to say that it's scary. But I think that I do feel like sometimes that these fears get kind of swept away as being like, well, these are not valid fears. It's like, well, because look, we know it's safe. We know this technology is safe. It's like, yeah, that's true. But I mean, like, literally, you and I, having been vaccinated, are like the long-term study. Like, sure, they're going to be talking to us in 10 years to be like, hey, how'd that go? So I don't think that that's an inaccurate fear. And that's not to try to be a fear monger. That is just to say, I think that that's a valid point. And
right.
We know that the technology is safe. We know that the concept is safe. But, you know, long-term studies will have to be performed.
Absolutely. But I can tell you that the long-term sequela of the infection of COVID is very real.
Also true. I mean, and that's the thing. We also don't know that. Like, we see that people, you know, they're coming out with new stuff all the time that say, oh, well, if you had COVID, now you end up with this 6 months later. You have this 6 months later. And some people get it and some people don't. And so there's definitely...
You don't know who's going to get really, really sick and who's
right.
not.
Right. I think that the distinction is there's a lot of unknowns on both sides.
Absolutely.
But it does seem like if you're hedging your bets, the unknown on the vaccine side seems like a safer bet than the unknown on the COVID side. And again, you know, I think that there are people who would probably take umbrage with my statement, but I think that it's a...
Yeah,
I think it's a valid discussion to have.
Absolutely. And it's a good discourse. And I really encourage people, like, I get the fear. So look into it. Speak with a physician who is up to date on evidence-based medicine practices and someone you trust, and have those good conversations around the dinner table with your family, and decide for yourselves what's best for you and your family. And we respect that. Absolutely. But do get educated and have the tough conversations. And we're always here to help you to understand the technology, to help you answer your questions, and to have good, honest, open conversations, because it is scary. You know, it is very scary to be able to, have something injected in your arm that is relatively, presumably new. But when you are faced with a global pandemic of that proportion that we've never seen before, and we've seen what it's just rocking the world and people's immune systems and long-term sequela, and people are still on oxygen, haven't gotten their smell back, you know, what the heck is that doing to your immune system? So with those sorts of things going on, and knowing the technology and the studies that have been done, it's not like no studies have been done. They've been extensively studied, and they've, you know, been proven safe in millions of people.
Sure.
So,
I mean, at this point, the rates are good.
Yeah.
Now, this is a sort of an interesting question that kind of ties into your field. They talk a little bit about allergies and like being allergic to the vaccine. So like,
right.
like if you're allergic to X, you shouldn't take the vaccine, or you have to sit here for 15 minutes so that we make sure you don't have anaphylaxis.
Yes.
Like, what's that about?
So there are components of the vaccination that if you ever have had anaphylaxis to any component of that vaccination, then you shouldn't get it. So that's a very, very small number of people. Basically, if you had a reaction to the first shot, a bad anaphylactic type reaction, then you shouldn't get the second shot.
Stands to reason.
Yeah, stands to reason, right? And so there are components of this, like polyethylene glycol, but there's no thimerosal, there's no B venom, there's no, what else have I heard in this vaccine?
I don't even know what thimerosal is.
Yeah.
You made that word up.
No, and that does not cause autism either. No vaccine does, but that's another story. So people are, you know, I had listed here the components of the vaccine I was going to list off, but anyway, I can tell you there's no latex, and so if you have a history of allergies, speak with your allergist. Prudent to receive your vaccination in a place where, in case anything were to happen, people can act upon that appropriately. So get your vaccine, wait 30 minutes. If you are prescribed an EpiPen by anyone, bring it to your vaccinations. you're probably not going to need it. That would be fantastic. And if you do, you have it. But food allergies, not a contraindication to getting the vaccine. You can still receive the vaccination. Mm-hmm. Drug allergies, not necessarily a contraindication to getting the vaccination. That is
not necessarily.
What
are the contraindications?
Contraindications are having a reaction to a previous dose of the vaccination,
sure,
or any component of the vaccine.
Okay.
Done. That's it.
Okay. That's not tough.
Right. Not if you're allergic to jelly beans, go get your vaccine.
Is anyone allergic to jelly beans?
Not if you have asthma, go get your vaccine.
Have you seen someone that's allergic to jelly beans?
That would be atrocious.
That would be really tragic.
Yeah. Anyone's allergic to anything, but yeah.
I mean, ugh, that would be so sad to me. Well, I mean, an interesting discussion. I appreciate your take on that, especially from the public health standpoint, because I think that is perhaps, to me, the most compelling of all the discussions about it.
And the scary part is, people are saying, my buddy got the vaccine and he still got COVID. Yeah, because the stuff keeps mutating. Now we're on the Gamma Delta variant or whatever? Like, we're going through the Greek alphabet here? I mean, what are we pledging?
I don't know who got to name these things.
I don't know what we're rushing here,
I think they were trying to avoid people names this time, because you know how we do that with hurricanes, and
that's
like, oh, Susan came through and destroyed everything,
and
then everybody
Susan.
Named Susan is really sad about it. So Delta, there's very few people named Delta. There's probably like two guys, and they're both sad about it, but...
I know. You know. But even if you get infected, the vaccine doesn't necessarily protect against not getting infected. It's if you do get infected, you're less likely to end up in the hospital on a vent.
Right.
And 90% of the new hospitalizations are among unvaccinated 20 to 40 year olds. And as of yesterday, there are 1,546 new COVID cases in a day, pushing Louisiana over 507,000. 20 new deaths recorded yesterday. That's 10,874 total as of yesterday. I didn't even look today. And the Louisiana Department of Health, its report is its third largest number of single-day new cases since the pandemic began. 844 patients in hospital, 64 on ventilators. And 97%, unfortunately, of the hospitalized patients with COVID are unvaccinated. And for people with small children who can't get the vaccine currently, as a mother, it's scary. And we're worried about them. So as adults, I kind of think we need to do our thing and be responsible. And, you know, the percentage of pediatric cases are rising to 16%. And that's an increase from 7% just 2 weeks ago. So it's doubled in that time. And it's scary with these gamma and delta variants and stuff. So I think that, you know, if the mRNA vaccines are more efficacious than the single shot Johnson & Johnson vaccination,
mm-hmm,
especially showing more neutralizing titer antibodies against the variants.
Sure.
So I think that cases going up across the country, it's prudent to, if you're not going to get vaccinated, how about wear a mask over your nose and mouth and stay at least 6 feet away from others? Avoid crowds and poorly ventilated spaces. Wash your hands, just like anything else. And if you are fully vaccinated, you know, be respectful of those that maybe choose not to. But, you know, have a good, honest, open conversation, because when we were able to speak about those fears and approach them with science and facts, then people can make good, educated decisions for themselves and their families.
I am stoked about the day that we don't have to talk about this anymore.
Yes.
That is what I look forward to most. Now, I'm playing the music again because I have another trivia question. And
fine.
I find that on a show about public health and health matters, the most important thing is that we get to all of my trivia questions.
Yes, agreed.
I mean, I can't think of anything more important than this. All right, so we've answered a question about cats. You are an allergist and immunologist. You deal with all these things. We've answered a question about cats. Now,
we're going
to have a cat. I know. I'm delighted. I put a notch in like the bedpost.
If you rub it in, just use hydrocortisone.
Okay, so now we're gonna go to dogs.
Okay.
Dogs are man's best friend, right?
Yes.
I'm a dog person. I'm sorry to all you cat people.
Diamonds are girl's best friend, but yes, dogs are man's best friend.
That's fair. I mean, you know, diamonds don't love you as much. But anyways, you can tell I'm a dog person. So all the cat people out there, I am sorry. But people claim that they are hyperallergenic dogs, but we've already decided that is not true. They've lied. So, but what do you know about just dogs in general? So again, three of these will be false and one of these will be true.
Okay.
Number one, 45% of U.S. dogs sleep in their owner's beds, and 70% of U.S. dog owners sign their dog's name on their Christmas card. Number two, dogs being left in cars is thought to be incredibly dangerous, but there's actually not been a documented case of car-related canine demise in over 30 years.
That's got to be false. Don't leave your dog in the car. That's terrible.
Number three.
Okay.
Dogs are known for burying bones. However, this phenomenon is only found north of the equator. For unknown reasons, Southern Hemisphere dogs do not bury their bones.
That would be fascinating.
And number four, dogs circling their beds before lying down is thought to herald back from when dogs slept in large packs and they didn't need to look in many directions to check their surroundings because they were a large group. And when alone, they have to check all sides many times before lying down to sleep.
I like that one.
One of these is true. So you're going to go with number four?
Well, I feel like I may or may not be signing Christmas cards with Lola's name and a little paw print, mm-hmm. but... And also we have Kona, that's a German Shepherd, but yeah, allergic to both. And by the way, I feel like it's the one where they do the thing around the bed and they kind of get comfy and then they sit there with the pack thing.
I'm so delighted you've gotten it wrong.
Oh, dang it!
Made my day.
Thank you so much.
So to address the one, there were 78 dogs that died in cars in 2018 because of heat related. Now, I will tell you, that is a lower number than I expected it to be because based on the amount of press it gets on like social media, I expected it to be like every other dog was in trouble from this, but I think it's like quicksand when you're a kid.
Wait, so number two, leaving your dog, that was true?
That is false. No, it's false.
Dogs do die left
in cars. Just not in the numbers that I was led to believe they do based on how prevalent it is
on social media.
Don't
leave dogs or children or EpiPens for that matter in the car.
Kids was like 50, dogs was like 78 in 2018. I mean, it's more than zero. The answer is 45% of U.S. dogs sleep in their owner's bed and 70% of U.S. dog owners sign their dog's name on their Christmas card. I feel a lot better about myself because I did that and I thought, oh no, I'm a weird dog person. And it turns out I am, but I'm also in the majority.
People love their dogs.
And I don't let my dog sleep in the bed.
No, I kicked mine out.
I'm not even allergic. I just think it makes the bed smell
hygienic.
Bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more, yeah. So either way, I thank you so much for getting both of those wrong today. You have made my day. I'm going to ride that high the rest of the day.
It hurts.
So let's talk. So we've talked a little bit about allergy. We've talked about the vaccine. I kind of want to know about the immunology side or the asthma side. I'm interested in both of those things. So let's talk asthma. First of all, what is asthma? Can you kind of give me a brief description as what is asthma?
Yes. Asthma is an obstructive lung disease where you may have bronchoconstriction and reversibility. Fancy schmancy words for your airway pipes kind of constrict down or squeeze tight because of the musculature or in reactivity or response to something. And then it reverses when you use your rescue inhaler or an inhaled steroid or bronchodilator.
Okay.
So your triggers might include if you get sick. Some people are totally fine until they get sick. Might include exercise. So some people have problems with exercise-induced asthma. Cold weather tends to get some people. And for some people, it's their allergens. And some people, it's irritants, fragrance, smoke, cigarette smoke, or just heavy fragrance or something like that. So we try to identify your triggers there to be able to reduce your symptoms.
So what do? Do you just like wave stuff at people and see if they have a hard time breathing?
Actually, yes. That's called a methacholine challenge, and it's still actually in practice. But personally just go by history.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, but we have a...
Way less exciting in the clinic,
though. Yeah, I know.
If you want an exciting Tuesday.
Nuremberg trial. We do this thing called spirometry, which is we do a lung test in the office, and you basically wrap your lips around this little kazoo, and we go blow, 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 blow for 6 seconds, exhale, and then you take a deep breath in, and then we look and see, compared to your height, ethnicity, and age, we kind of say where you should be. So you're not comparing like Yoko Ono to Shaquille O'Neal. You know, that wouldn't be fair. So you're comparing.
I don't know.
Right? I mean, feel like she blew away the Beatles pretty well.
I would say that was a phenomenal like pairing of people that you just chose. And I actually would be interested to see those results.
But you can't compare a small Asian woman to a large black male.
But she was a singer.
She was.
And he was not known for his cardio.
All right. You know what then?
Maybe their
populations are comparable. But
they might be.
So when you're looking at how much air should be coming out of those lungs, right? You can look based on that data. So once again, public health, and we're pooling this data to look at where you should be in relation to everybody else. So can you put out 2 liters of air? Can you put out 4 liters of air? So kind of think of your lungs as 2-liter bottles. And if you are obstructed, you're not getting out all of that air. Happy birthday to you. Blow out your candles. You should be able to get out 80% of your candles in the first blow, in the first second. And then eventually you get out all of them. So if you look at how much you get out in that first blow, it should be 80%. If it's not, then we give you a little puffy puff rescue inhaler and see if it gets better. Mm-hmm. If it gets better by like a Coke can or better, then it's reversible. So that's asthma. That's the definition of asthma.
Now, how's that different than COPD?
COPD does not reverse when you give them that rescue inhaler. People have them, right? But okay. We use them for kind of symptomatic control. But it's obstructive. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. So it doesn't reverse as easily mm-hmm. with the albuterol. And that's the difference. Basically, both obstructive, doesn't reverse. Both air stack. So you kind of have this like you're breathing in, but you can't breathe it out very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of feel like you got stale air in there. It's not really getting out as well. So in both instances, we tried to avoid our triggers, and we keep on the medications, daily inhalers, if you have that, that reduce the inflammation in the lungs and help you to manage those symptoms. And we ask you every time you come in, hey, are you having symptoms at night? Are you waking up in the middle of the night, coughing, shortness of breath, chest tightness, wheezing? Those are characteristic symptoms. And how frequently are they happening? Because if you're puffing that albuterol inhaler mm-hmm. or that rescue inhaler more than like 2 times a week, if you're not sick and not pre-exercise, which is also kind of a freebie, then you're not as well controlled as you kind of could be. And then so we look at things like, are you filling your meds? Are you taking your inhaler the right way? Like I had some sweet little lady and she's like, Caperton, I'm doing all the stuff. And I'm like, how are you using your inhaler? And she was like blowing out. And I'm like, sweetheart, inhale it. It's an inhaler, you know? So you kind of have to go over the technique of how they're using it.
No,
are they
that
filling
was a gimme.
It? Yeah. Are they having any side effects? So some people get a little thrush with an inhaler. So you're supposed to kind of wash your mouth out or brush your teeth after mm-hmm. you use it. And if you're doing all the right stuff, maybe then you're not as optimally controlled as you need to be. So either step up on your meds along with your pulmonologist or your allergist or your primary care physician. Or we look at what's triggering you. When are you tripping up? Oh, man, every spring and fall. Okay, well, that kind of might be a seasonal trigger with pollens or something.
Right.
Oh, man, my wife just got a new cat. Okay, we're ragging on cats today. But
maybe she got a new iguana.
Yeah, well, huh. That would probably not be as...
Reptiles have no allergenic component.
If you don't clean the thing, they're probably going to have some situational like mold or like, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, we just need to not pick on cats.
Don't pick on cats. But dogs. Or you got, I have this great cartoon that I just want to frame in the office, and it has got this cartoon of this lady, and she's holding a pug, and she's like, we had to get rid of the children. Mr. Pugglesworth was allergic. I know.
Oh, that's actually pretty phenomenal. Is that in your office?
It's not. They won't let me hang it.
Why not?
I think it's great, right?
Come on.
Anyway.
Do it anyways. What are they going to say? They can't fire you.
They might. So anyway, but yeah, so like in conjunction with your allergist, if you're having a lot of triggers, or if say you got sick from a viral upper respiratory infection, or you got COVID and now you're having this situation with your lungs where you might have had asthma before and now you're really having trouble, or you got this bad upper respiratory infection, it's just not going away.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things to kind of look at what's triggering you, stress or your allergens. And so we work in conjunction. There's certain cells that we can look at and say, hey, oh yeah, you got my boys, the eosinophils. That's my allergy cells. Those are higher in your blood than the average bear. So maybe you're allergic triggered asthma. So then we look to reduce your allergic triggers. And then sometimes there's how many times have you gotten a steroid shot in the last year, right? Like how many times have you had to go to the emergency room or quick care? That's kind of not as well-controlled asthma. So if some people are like, I'm really good, I don't need to use my inhaler. Well, your pharmacy record that shows you've used systemic steroids or a Medrol dose pack like 3 times in the last 3 months kind of disagrees with your assessment.
You know?
Like maybe a microgram of milligrams is what happens when you get your hip injected or you go and get a systemic steroids like prednisone or Medrol dose pack. That's milligrams of steroid. 1,000-fold less dose is micrograms. It's just a little bitty steroid. And you're going to inhale it every day in teeny tiny doses. That's going to keep the inflammation down in your lungs so you never have to get this 1,000-fold higher dose.
Right.
And so that kind of thing, helping patients to understand why we're doing that. And
so what is a good goal for someone? Because I feel like part of the problem is a lot of people don't understand that there is a better, you know, that like they're getting a Medrol dose pack once a month, and to them that's pretty good. They're like, this is how everybody lives, right? This is just how it goes.
Oh, man.
So like
it's like saving a friend that's dating the wrong person, and you're like, dude, you don't even know how good it could
be. Right.
So
how good can it be?
Bad
like what's a good standard for someone to look
good
at?
Good standard is no systemic steroids. You don't ever have to live like that. You know, like mm-hmm. how many times is it okay for them to treat you badly? That's the kind of thing, you know?
So you should never have a systemic steroid.
Well, you shouldn't have to. If you're really well controlled, like how many times are you going to need to go in the hospital? well, just once a year, that's pretty good. No, it's not. It's really not. You don't, you know, if you're really well controlled on your asthmatic regimen and you're reducing your allergenicity by maybe you're on the right regimen for medicines. Maybe you're avoiding your allergens. Maybe you're on allergy shots if you don't want to get rid of your dog or something. And then maybe you're on the right targeted medications. That talking about systemic targeted biologics for things. If you have high eosinophils or allergy cells in your blood, there's targeted biologic treatments now that can take out just your eosinophils and then reduce your exacerbations for asthma. So those sorts of things, by optimizing your treatment specific for you, we can reduce your exacerbations, reduce the amount of time you're off of work or missing school or in the hospital or taking steroids, which have collateral damage. You know, systemic steroids raise your blood pressure, increase your risk of strokes, increase your risk of osteoporosis, cause stomach ulcers, degenerate your bones. They're really great in the moment, but that Celestone shot you're getting every month, you're going to pay for down the road. It's a really quick Band-Aid, but it's not going to solve the problem of why you got there in the first place. So
if somebody has a problem, I mean, do they need to talk to their, you know, as we're kind of trying to wrap up, if someone has a problem with this, and it sounds like, you know, if you're out there listening and you're like, oh no, my asthma is not well controlled, like, what's their first step? Do they call their PCP? Do they call you? I mean, what do they do?
Either way, call your PCP, and that's the first step toward getting into a referral for a specialist. And so the PCP, we work in conjunction with them. So if you're well controlled, you know, maybe you're not well controlled, you come see me, I kind of fix things, and I send you back to your primary care so we can kind of get you on the good thing. And we tinker with things and we send you back. So I work in partnership with your primary care. So that would be the first place I would start.
Okay. Well, I mean, Dr. Caperton, I know that we've got a lot more to talk about. I feel like we got barely to any of the questions that I had for you today.
I kind
of
went on a hijacked the program there. I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh.
You know what? Sorry, not sorry.
That is what the program exists to have. So I thank you so much for coming to join us. I know that we'll have you back on. We've had you before. So thank you again.
I really appreciate your time, Dr. Lava. Thank you.
Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. And thanks to Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence for providing phone assistance this evening. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters may not reflect those of the station, LSUS, or staff. This program will be available for podcast online at redriverradio.org. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Patrick Lavo. Thank you for being a part of the audience this evening. Tune in next Thursday for another edition of Health Matters. Thank you, Dr. Caperton.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lavo.